You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
And our bedroom, as we discovered after the fall of the wall and suspected at the time, the wall was absolutely riddled with bugs. And the upper Zentrale, as in Lives of Others, the movie Lives of Others, the Stasi agents were sitting literally on the other side of the wall from the end of our bed.
This is Cold War Conversations. If you're new here, you've come to the right place to listen to first-hand Cold War history accounts. Do make sure you follow us in your podcast app or join our emailing list at coldwarconversations.com. In this episode, we talk to Mark Brain again, and it's a wide-ranging interview about his career as a Reuters and BBC journalist, including details of his Stasi file, his time in the Soviet Union, Hungary and Poland, as well as the perils of editing analogue tape in a non-digital age. Among his interviewees, we talk about the Dalai Lama and Lech Walesa, as well as the ordinary people of the Warsaw Pact countries. If you're enjoying the podcast, please leave a written review in Apple Podcasts or share us on social media. By telling your friends, you can really help the podcast grow. And if you can spare it, I'm asking listeners to contribute $3 per month to help keep us on the air. Larger amounts are welcome too. Plus, you get a sought-after Cold War Conversations coaster as a monthly financial supporter, and you bask in the warm glow of knowing you are helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate. So, back to today's episode. This is part two of three episodes with Mark. And as you will hear, we had a lot of fun recording this. We welcome Mark Brain back to our Cold War conversation. You said before we came on air that you had your Stasi file there.
I've got three. When I looked at them for the first time, literally on November the 9th, 1999, it was on the 10th anniversary, literally, of the wall opening up. And I was at the Stasi place just off Alexanderplatz in East Berlin. And they brought out all the files, and it was 2,700 pages of them, and it was about a meter and a half tall. So I spent the entire day going through them and reading them all, and it was a very powerful experience, because I was just actually in the process also. My marriage was ending; it had just ended, in fact, to Jutta. At that point, and I stood on the top of there was a big reception at the. At the new parliament, at the Reichstag, there was a big reception in the Reichstag organized by the Freedom Forum to mark the 10th anniversary of the wall opening up. And we, a lot of senior politicians, I think the president was there, the German president was there. I was looking out from the roof of the Reichstag down over what had been then East Berlin and up to Schönhauser Allee, remembering our time together and knowing that the marriage had come to an end at that point. I just spent all day going through my Stasi files and reading of, you know, the very beginnings of our marriage in East Berlin and my activities as Martin, this well-known. They thought that I might be an agent and realized that I wasn't, and they sort of slightly lost interest, actually. We perhaps need to get to that. But it was interesting remembering how the marriage started and ended. It had a kind of arc, because Jutta and I married in March 1977, in this big church in the south of West Germany. But then we had our first 2 years in the Reuter flat in East Berlin. And our bedroom, as we discovered after the fall of the wall and suspected at the time, was the wall was absolutely riddled with bugs. and the Abhörzentrale, as in Lives of Others, the movie Lives of Others.
Yeah.
The Stasi agents were sitting literally on the other side of the wall from the end of our bed. So the wall was, I don't know, perhaps, you know, sort of 10 centimeters, 15 centimeters thick. So there was our marital bed for 2 years on one side of the wall. And the other side of the wall was a whole array of Stasi listening gear and tape recorders and all the rest of it. So perhaps that's one of the reasons that our marriage had a bit of a rocky time later on. Genuinely, actually.
That must have been really strange reading that file and hearing this sort of like third party's view of your life and your relationship as well in that moment in time for you.
It was a slightly unreal experience, but the extraordinary thing was that the agents, the bureaucrats really from the Stasi who were putting the files together and collecting the reports and piling up this vast amount of information about, you know, their own citizens and those of us who were living among them and might be deemed agents or anti-socialist elements or, you know, danger, a source of dangerous undermining of the state. The extraordinary thing is the extent to which it was very ordinary. And you know, going through my files and reading their conclusions that they came to me, it was a bit like reading a sort of, you know, annual report at the BBC, giving me marks at the end of the year. And there's one page which I just smile enormously. They were looking at my reports for Reuters and they were marking them. Are they factually neutral, anti-socialist, or positive? I think there were four grades on the sort of anti-socialist scale. And some of my reports were sort of neutral, but most of them had a tick anti-socialist. So I was being evaluated. I didn't get a bonus, by the way, at the end of the year. and some of the agents who were writing about me were quite insightful. And one of them wrote how Martin hadet mit dem Schicksal, which roughly translated would mean he struggles with his fate. And I was very intense, you know, as a young man. I remain fairly intense as an old man. But they clocked my psychology, really. And they clocked, I think, that, you know, Jutta was probably having a slightly entertaining time getting used to being married to me. But they never tried anything on. And they clocked a huge amount of boring detail about comings and goings and who I met and who I was having dinner with. And most of it is pretty belanglos, pretty meaningless stuff. But some of it was curious about. I would say was curious about me and what made me tick. They were trying to work out what basically was I MI6. And once they realized that, no, don't think so. and I wasn't, by the way, I genuinely wasn't. And I'm not just saying that.
No, I know, because I know that Reuters was a potentially fertile ground for MI6.
Yes, I don't know if you've ever anybody's fessed up on any one of your broadcasts to having actually done both, you know, played both sides.
I was hoping you were going to, Mark, but sadly not.
But I was approached by the by MI6 in Vienna after I'd got a particularly interesting interview in the Czechoslovakia, nearly said Czech Republic, of course it wasn't that at the time. But the cousin of my headmaster at school, you know, very old boy, said sort of, "Oh boy, you know, really interested in your interview, and you could be jolly useful to us, you know. No compromise, and no expectations, but we'd like to give it some thought. You know, perhaps you could sort of, you know, help us a bit, you know, in your travels around Czechoslovakia." And I took about 2 milliseconds to say, "Thanks, but no thanks. Not the sort of thing I'm going to do." But that was the only time that anybody really tried it on.
But it was the classic approach from, you know, somebody from the same, not the same school, but that same background.
Absolutely,
and,
yeah. You know. Bruce Lockhart, big family of English British spies. Anyway, I've got these three, because I had these vast files that I went through, and I did it from our own correspondent for the BBC, which is actually still on the BBC website.
I'll have to find that.
Yeah, it was quite fun because I quote in there from I broadcast it in November 1999. It was one of the last pieces I did of broadcasting for the BBC. I then asked to have the whole lot photocopied and sent on, which they did for a nominal fee. They were so efficient. They were really kind. And I've got these three ring binders full, and I've just opened one. It's fallen open here on page. I think, oh, blimey, I was just reminding myself, Ian. And here there's a list of things I was doing in Dresden by the minute. Then I was visiting Dresden and the art exhibition in Dresden and going to the library where a choir friend of mine was working in the Dresden library, and where I was, what I was wearing. And they didn't really coordinate terribly well. So the Stasi in Dresden were reporting back to the to sort of Stasi Central, and there were all kinds of things. They hadn't a clue about me at all. They hadn't actually read up on me beforehand. Here's a photograph of me taken out of a briefcase, and I'm looking very young. I'm just as I'm talking to you. There's Jutta, and I need to send you a copy here.
Oh, I've got to see a copy of that.
You've got to see a copy. Okay,
that sounds sensational.
I'll make a note, and you can put it on the website. So they were sort of following us around, you know, with cameras in briefcases so we wouldn't notice.
This is James Bond stuff,
Mark. Oh, it is, yeah. Here we are. Every page has got a picture. So, yeah, you know, I look very young. I've got a bit more hair than I have now.
But this is the weirdness about the Stasi, is the banality that they recorded. Ah, but yeah. But the thing is I was speaking to a history professor in Australia, and she's saying that the whole of the Stasi archive is a almost fascinating anthropological study,
yes,
of people, really. Yep. If you actually analyze it, I know, you know, some of the data there is not necessarily going to be, you know, hugely accurate, but it's a study of a country, really.
Well, the funny thing is, Ian, it is accurate. You know, every observation is accurate. What I was doing, who I was meeting, the kind of things that we were discussing. What is inaccurate is the interpretation that they put on it. They're right. Constantly looking for proof that I'm trying to undermine the socialist state order and all that kind of stuff. But the pure observation is it's an anthropological study. One particularly my two years with Reuters. There's rather less. Let me just get there. Just looking through binder one at the moment. Let me just remind myself of binder three. It is
maybe they give a review of your singing in binder one.
No, they didn't. They should have, because it was quite good. But the interesting thing is that I don't think there were anybody reporting on us from the choir, because they didn't seem to have any inside information from the choir, and they were so didn't have inside information from the choir because they. Mm. They named the wrong choir, but also the only reference to the choir that I came is somebody in the choir told the Stasi that Mrs. Brain seems to be pregnant. So this was when Jutta was pregnant with our first child.
What was the most surprising thing you found in that file?
I think the most surprising thing I found was how little I was spied on by friends. I was in a... Maybe it was because it was in the church. Maybe it was because it was in the church, but then there were people who were spying furiously in the church. Maybe it was because of the choir. The people who sang in the choir were people of quite considerable integrity, I would say. You know, the Hildebrandts who ran it, and Jörg Hildebrandt and Herbert Hildebrandt, very close as brothers, and Regina Hildebrandt, who then goes on, you know, in United Germany to be a major figure in the SPD and bring in integrity that made her beloved of all Germans, interestingly. And we had that quality of cleanliness, if you like, relational cleanliness, clarity, and kindness. There was a lot of good in that choir. Mm. So I think that was sort of what I was surprised about. I do actually, interestingly, need to read all of this again. There's just vast pages to remind myself of some of the detail, because I haven't read this now for 1999, so, you know, 20 years. I haven't opened these files for 20 years.
Wow.
I'm just leafing through them as we speak.
It's unusual for you not to find somebody effectively spying on you who, you know, you considered a friend from the people that I've spoken to in other interviews. So generally the people who were spying on you were sort of like a little bit removed from your main circle of friends by the sounds of it.
That's right. I had journalistic contacts. There was one from the peasants newspaper, the Bauernzeitung, which was the organ, the party organ of one of these nominally independent non-communist parties in East Germany. There were four of them, I think. They were the Liberal Democrats and the Bauernpartei. And I met this chap at the party conference of the Peasants Party. And he was obviously reasonably well connected. He'd probably been put on me, sort of set on me by the Stasi. But anyway, we became sort of friends and contacts, and I visited him in his dacha outside East Berlin. And he visited me later, and we'd have lunch every now and again. He didn't really give me any newsworthy information, but you never know what you're going to pick up. And when I was with the BBC in West Berlin, living in Johannesburg, Allee, he came to visit once, interestingly, visiting West Berlin as a member of the East German establishment. And I was pretty certain that he was reporting back to the Stasi. What I didn't realize is the detail with which he was reporting back to the Stasi. And he went back, and I discovered in my file a sketched plan of our house in West Berlin. So he actually drew a sort of floor plan of the house for his offices in East Berlin, in the Stasi. That was pretty detailed. The other spy I had, I have to smile, was Vítězslav Havlíček from Rudy Pravo. Rudy Pravo, the Czechoslovak
party newspaper, wasn't it?
Yeah. And Vítězslav was their East Berlin, their GDR correspondent in the capital of the GDR. And we used to hang out together quite a bit. And I loved him. He was a complete rogue. I'm sure he was spying for the KGB and the CIA and MI6 as well. But we'd have him round for dinner, and he was clearly, I find a lot of stuff in the files about things that we said at dinner, and none of it was of any significance whatsoever. So he would enjoy the hospitality and get merrily drunk and go back and earn his keep with his Stasi officers and report meaningless rubbish to them, which didn't help at all build the case against me as an anti-socialist underminer of the state or anything, but it kept him quite nicely in beer, I think.
Yeah. Whereas would you have talked to, did he not report on some of the stuff that you talked about then?
Well, the stuff we talked about was what was going on in East Germany and the politics and East West. And most of what we talked about was relatively well known, relatively common knowledge. And it was in the newspapers. So there wasn't very much sort of privileged information knocking about in East Germany at all. You just couldn't get at it. One of the little things that I really found it really interesting in was just how what a good journalist the Stasi thought I was, which is very flattering. I didn't think it myself at the time. That's one of the reasons I became a psychotherapist, to try and sort that stuff out. But I'm characterized in a number of places in my Stasi files, alongside being anti-socialist and an underminer of the state and all this sort of gumph they had to put in there. He's a very diligent journalist. He's an extremely sought-after source for Western correspondents and journalists visiting East Berlin. Every English-language correspondent journalist who comes to East Berlin seeks out Martin. And visiting journalists find his analysis of GDR event, goings on, highly reliable. He's considered to be extremely well connected. All sorts of wonderful stuff, better than anything I ever got from the BBC, quite honestly.
But you're right. It sounds like a performance review.
It was a performance review, but I never got the payoff.
Shared that with the BBC. You could have got a promotion. Now, before we get to Romania, I just want to go back to the Soviet Union, which I know is sort of almost the start of your story in Eastern Europe, because I'm still intrigued by how you managed to get so close to Andrei Sakharov.
Oh, well, if you worked as a Western journalist, an English language journalist in Moscow in 1974, 1975, you were close to Andrei Sakharov. He was a kind of news, a kind of one.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
One man and one woman, because his wife, Yelena Bonner, was tremendously significant in his life. He was a man of just towering integrity and courage. And he was the reference point for the refuseniks, the Jewish dissidents who basically wanted out, and for the dissidents in the aftermath of the Brezhnev trials in the late 60s, where who were agitating from within for against the system. So there were these two strands of opposition to the to communist the communist ideology and rule, and Sakharov embraced both. I mean, obviously a Russian, not from Jewish descent himself, but he really cared about the right thing being done, and he obviously had the integrity and courage to break away from the Soviet military program when he realized that it was being used to rather ends that he couldn't sign up to. So in the mid-70s, before he got sent off to exile in Gorky, he was the go-to person. So when you arrived with Reuters as a correspondent, as a junior correspondent, it was a training post in May 1974. One of the first things that Bob Evans did as the Reuters, well, Vincent Buist was the Reuters bureau chief at the time, but Bob was number two, and I think it was Bob who took me to meet Sakharov. It was a kind of rite of passage that when you arrived as a English language journalist, Western journalist in Moscow, you were taken to meet Sakharov. It was just par for the course. And then I used to make a point, we all did in our different ways, of visiting him pretty regularly on his flat on the Garden Ring, and drinking tea in his kitchen. I have a photograph of when I'm particularly proud of taking notes as he's sort of giving a press conference, in effect, to a bunch of us Western journalists from Scandinavia and from America and from England. And he got quite fond of us as well, because it was a kind of personal relationship. It wasn't just passing on information. That was why when I moved to East Berlin from Moscow at the end, so after a year in London through 1976 and started up in East Berlin in 1977, I'd expected there to be a kind of dissident network, but it just didn't work like that. So Stefan Heim, who I'd hoped would be my go-to source, wasn't, and he wasn't connected into the network of dissident activity. Because the huge difference between Russia, between the Soviet Union and East Germany, was that there was no West Soviet Union. So the whole German dissident resistance to the state was so part of West German identity, and people watching West German television identifying with West German values, with collective German values. But Russia, the Soviet Union, was Russian, and the Russian exiles were in parts of New York. It was a totally different, or Israel. It was a totally different mindset. So the Russian dissidents, like Sakharov, were not trying to leave, apart from the Jewish refuseniks were, but dissidents like Sakharov were really wanted to bring about reform, which of course they did in the end, in the end of the 1980s.
Yeah. And why did the Soviets not stop him? I know he was exiled to Gorky in the end, but obviously there was a considerable period where he was able to freely speak with Western journalists.
That is the paradox of Russia. My goodness me. Didn't somebody once say something about a riddle wrapped in an enigma and all the rest of it?
It was Churchill, I think,
exactly.
Yeah.
Yes, it was. That's the craziness of Russia. I mean, Russia is a land where everything is forbidden and everything is possible. And that way, in Soviet times, it was the same. I went back, my wife and I went back to Russia a couple of years ago for the first time after many years, and absolutely loved it. It's just changed. I just love Russia. It's now, despite Putin and all the rest of it, the politics, the Russians are now able to be Russian in the best sense, and they've picked up the old traditions, and they've sort of rather embarrassed about sort of the small matter of 70 years of communism. They're so much more proud of their Tsarist heritage and their culinary traditions and their history. And it's just a pleasure to visit Russia these days. And the funny thing is, under the surface, that was there during Soviet times too. Of course it was.
Yeah.
And I think the fact that the Soviet system let Sakharov do an honorable thing, it probably was in some way, you know, there was decency there. It wasn't just awfulness, although God knows there was enough of that. And it wasn't Stalin's Russia.
In Moscow, I mean, Philby and Burgess would have still been around then, wouldn't they? Or not?
We had no idea. There was no contact with that I knew of with Philby and Burgess and people. None whatsoever. We lived in a bit of a bubble, Western journalists, and we self-referenced across the piece with American journalists and a few German journalists I was close to, and the German embassy and the American embassy, the British embassy, the Canadians. And we lived in a kind of journalistic diplomatic echo chamber where we were knocking stories around. And you've probably talked to Reuters correspondents, talking to Peter Miller and others who were in Moscow as well. I'm sure they've told you the story of the puppet theater just over the road from Sad Sam, Sadovaya Samotyochnaya, on the Garden Ring. The dissidents or the people who had a gripe against the state would ring us in the Reuters bureau and arrange to meet in front of the puppet theater, Kukolny Teatr, with its every quarter of an hour, it blasted out this song right across metallic chimes every quarter of an hour over the Reuters bureau on the other side of the Garden Ring, sort of multi-lane highway around the edge of the center of Moscow. And we would go out and meet these guys, and they'd have these huge, long zayavlenia, these great big tracts of fulmination against the state or personal grievances about how they'd been wronged by the state or by this ministry or that ministry. And we'd sort of patiently take them in and file them and never report them. But there was this sort of this curious dance that we did in the diplomatic echo chamber, the news reporting echo chamber following TASS and following Pravda and all the rest of it. But then this sort of on the edges of it, we had these connections into ordinary Russia, some of which was usable, but an awful lot of it was just as over the centuries people have come up from the provinces to complain to the Tsar. They carried on doing it through Soviet times, but nobody was listening. And to be honest, we weren't either.
Right. Okay. Well, no, I appreciate that. That was interesting again. So on to Romania. So from Berlin, you end up being you become BBC Central European correspondent based in Vienna.
That's right. Covering world service correspondent, radio correspondent, because radio and television weren't integrated in those days. And obviously there were no social media or anything like that. So it was a fairly, by today's standards, a fairly simple task of just producing radio reports and features. And from our own correspondence, which I used to do in vast numbers. So I was based in Vienna, but traveling a lot to Prague, to Bratislava. In the first year of 1981, moving to Vienna, I spent a lot of time in Poland. Solidarity Poland. So I stood in for Tim Sebastian quite a lot as BBC Radio in Warsaw and covered the Eighth Party Congress of the Polish United Workers Party at the height of the Solidarity era, but didn't get back after martial law.
Right.
So I was covering a lot of Poland during the summer of the summer and the autumn of 1981.
Interview many of the Solidarity leaders or any of them?
Yeah, I interviewed Lech Wałęsa. I think I remember interviewing Wałęsa. Maybe that's a kind of one of these reconstructed memories, but I certainly went up to Gdansk to report the Solidarity Congress towards the end of 1981 before martial law was declared. But it was a very exciting time. It had the buzz of it of rather like I imagine Prague must have been in 1968. My moment of triumph, I just have to share this with you. Radio, we were working on tape, of course, in those days, not digital. So all of the editing and interviews had to be done on a Ewer, what was called a Ewer, with reel-to-reel tape, or recorded on a Sony Walkman on a cassette, but then transferred onto reel-to-reel and edited on a Revox on a big machine with razor blades and China graphs and so on.
Wow.
And I went out and did a whole set of Vox Pops, talking to the people on the streets of Warsaw. And it was early days in radio, and I hadn't yet worked out how to edit tape quite as elegantly as I learnt to do later. And I recorded a whole bunch of interviews with an interpreter, doing the English and then the Polish. But my Polish, I could understand a certain amount of Polish on the basis of my Russian, but obviously I needed an interpreter, and I needed that then to be, that would be the voice that was broadcast for the BBC radio package. And I took all this back to the office in the center of Warsaw and transferred it all to tape and started editing it through. I might have even recorded it on a Ewer, come to think of it. So it was the original tape. And I realized that if, rather than cutting out the ums and the ers, we used to call it de-umming, and rather than cutting out just one sticking it together, checking whether I'd done it right, I could do a kind of sequential series of ums where I could mark the tape up, because I was getting quite good at knowing exactly on the tape where to cut. So I could do a series of marks on the tape so that I could edit out a whole bunch of ums in one go and put them on the floor, just let them fall to the floor in little tiny snippets, and then join up the rest of the coherent interview. Guess what?
I think I know where this might be going.
I got one out. So I got one out. I ended up with all of the interview on the floor and one endless series of ums. I wish I kept it.
I'm with you there. I mean, editing in digital is obviously a lot easier, and you know, you can see the sound wave for an in digital.
Yeah.
A lot of the time. So you can identify it, and you can do a, you know, almost like a find and replace.
Yeah.
But if you do that, it can be deadly, because it's still not precise. Well, certainly I can't get it precise in digital. So I genuinely feel for you there.
Anyway, I got very, very good, Ian, actually, at editing tape. And when I was in China, I had an interview, an interpreter, a young lad in the office who was lovely chap, Xiao Ding, Little Ding, we called him. And he would be my voice. So he was the voice of virtually everybody in China I ever interviewed, because he was the English voice on the in situ, because my Mandarin wasn't good enough to understand what people were saying. So I'd record his voice, but he used to say these instead of this. So I used to go through interviews being a perfectionist, and I'd used to shorten the E in these to turn it into this. And so it's on my blog, cyclotherapist.com. I've got some of these originals of Xiao Ding and his pieces unmixed, the original features before they were mixed for the Today program. And you can hear the elegance of the editing. And, oh, yes, I've got to tell you one more thing. I interviewed the Dalai Lama in Brussels in a hotel room right at the end of the Cold War. And he was the most wonderful man. I mean, it was the most extraordinary interview I've ever done. I came out there on cloud nine. I mean, he was just such a lovely man. But my goodness me, does he. He is the biggest ummer on the planet. He still is. And he giggles, the laughing monk. And I had a 3.5 minute interview on PM, on Radio 4 PM. And I swear not, I kid you not, I had 120 edits in 3.5 minutes. I was proud of that.
I mean, I spend quite a bit of time getting rid of my ums, to be honest. I'm not sure I'm up at the same level as the Dalai Lama. I would expect him to be a lovely man as well. He just comes across as that. So...
He's up there with Sakharov, or Sakharov's up there with him. You know, the one or two extraordinary men I met in my travels, and by whom I felt touched. I never met Mandela because I never covered Africa, but certainly the Dalai Lama and Sakharov were two very hugely powerful influences just on me, just the encounters that I had with them.
Yeah. That's not a bad two to have an encounter with, I would say. So. I keep trying to drag us back to Romania, but I get distracted.
You were asking about Romania. Well, from Vienna, I was covering, responsible for radio coverage for BBC Radio for Czechoslovakia, Poland as a backstop, Hungary, which I loved, and I spent a lot of time studying Hungarian. I love the Hungarian language. Bonkers though it is, completely upside down.
Well, that's supposed to be one of the I mean, I know it's sort of from the Finnic-Ugric branch of languages or something.
That's right, yeah. And they famously said when they were emigrating from Mongolia, where they originally came from, there was a sign which said, Finns this way, Hungarians this way. And depending on whether you're Finnish or Hungarian, they say that those who could read went to Hungary or went to Finland. The other people who couldn't read went the other way. Anyway, so then I covered Hungary and used to use every excuse to nip down to Budapest, which was the happiest barracks in the block, as I used to call it. And I was accredited in Bulgaria, visited Bulgaria a few times. Romania, I went to, and Yugoslavia. I covered Yugoslavia. So I spent a lot of time in Yugoslavia post-Tito, because Tito had died a year before I got there.
Right.
And I went down to Kosovo right at the beginning of my time in Central Europe. And I was covered Albania as well, though I never got into Albania at that time. I did visit Albania later as European regional editor for the language services in the 90s.
God, I can't think. There's not many countries in the Eastern Bloc, certainly European Eastern Bloc, you've not covered at some point then.
I don't think there are any.
I'm trying to – yeah, I can't think of one now, that you've said Albania.
No, I reported from Moldavia, you know, in the Soviet Union. Yeah, absolutely. I've never reported from Belarus. I've been to Minsk, but never reported from Belarus. But yeah. That was my patch. So I just traveled all over the place. And the curious thing about those days, Ian, was that there wasn't really much of a story. You sort of made your own story. You made your own wind, as it were. You created your own story. Because nobody in the West was terribly interested in the minutiae of what was going on in Eastern Europe. They understood – people in the West looked at Eastern Europe and thought, well, Prague, Warsaw, Romania, Russia, it's all the same thing. It's just the Eastern
Europe.
They had no idea about these different countries. And the American presidents didn't understand the difference between Slovakia and Slovenia, famously. So I'd just say, hey, it's time to go and visit Hungary, or it's time to visit Yugoslavia. And I would head off and I'd go do some interviews and get some good features and I used to do a lot of radio features, just ordinary life, because there wasn't really much happening on the big political front, apart from the big Cold War stories. But once you'd done that, what else were you going to do? You know, wasn't a lot to sort of to interview or to talk. So I used to try and report back for the Today program or for the various English language stuff on the World Service, just about ordinary life. What it's like to be an ordinary Czech, or tennis in Czechoslovakia, or gypsies in Slovakia, or Hungary bathhouses in Budapest. And it got a certain traction. Most of my ordinary reporting was done really on the basis of news agency coverage coming out from the various national news agencies, which came in on a collected feed with APA, APA, Austrian Press Agency. I used to come in on a ticker in Vienna. So a lot of my reporting was based just on what the news agencies of the various countries were reporting. And based on my traveling around, I had a feel for how those stories really resonated and how they needed to be reported. So Romania, you asked about Romania.
Yes. you had some difficulties there.
I had a little local difficulty in Romania, yes.
Hi, this is Rhonda in Virginia, and I support Cold War Conversations because I think the work that Ian is doing is critically important. I think it's vital to record the firsthand accounts of people who lived and experienced the Cold War because it illustrates history in a way that a book never can. So thank you so much for the podcast. It's my favorite podcast, and I look forward to it every week.
To be like Rhonda and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War, as a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free, you'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more.
Just before I talk about my little local difficulty in Romania, I was just reading my Stasi file and reminding myself that the Stasi got it into their head from some chance remark from a British diplomat that I somehow had fallen out with Reuters and joined the BBC because I had left Reuters in some kind of disgrace for having been involved in some kind of scam. And the Stasi got their hands on this and they kept repeating it through my files. It was completely untrue. I chose to go to BBC from Reuters because I wanted to do radio rather than news agency. But these agencies, you know, these intelligence agencies or lack of intelligence agencies would get their eye. They would sort of come across an idea and repeat it to themselves and persuade themselves that it was true, just like a lot of journalists used to do in our coverage of the stories we were covering. So, you know, one journalist feeding on another. Anyway, back to Romania. Right. I get to Vienna in April 1981, and I managed to get to Romania three times before the autumn of 1981, despite all that traveling to Poland. And my last visit to Romania in 1982, early 1982, I think it was, Bill Mitchell from the Detroit Free Press at the time and I drove all the way from Vienna to Bucharest through Hungary, which was the most extraordinary drive. And it took us right past a town called Skornicest, which was Ceausescu's birthplace. Mm-hmm. So in the Ceausescu era, and it is pronounced Ceausescu, by the way, not Ceausescu, as many people incorrectly.
That's
write.
Where I've been going wrong. That's why I get one-star reviews on my pronunciation.
Don't you dare cut this out of the podcast.
Don't worry, I won't. I won't.
Ceausescu, S with a little
Ceausescu.
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 Ceausescu. Yeah, Ceausescu.
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 Hi, well done. You got it. I think he's got it.
Right.
As Doolittle would say.
I'll keep practicing.
Keep practicing.
For my next episode on Romania.
That's right. Anyway, so Skornicest, which is written at the end with S-T-I, so it's not Skornicesti, because T-I in Romania is a soft T.
Skornicesti. I'm learning so much.
Well, there you go.
Today.
I'm a bit of a linguistic nerd. So Bill and I called in on Skornicest, and we drove into Skornicest in my VW Green Passat, and knowing that it was Ceausescu's birthplace, and it was sort of a rather better class Romanian small town, which is not saying a lot, but there was food in the shops, and it sort of was brightly coloured. It was definitely a nicer place than most dreadful, godforsaken Romanian villages at the time, because it was at the height of the campaign that Ceausescu was running to erase all the villages and put people in high rises and literally bulldoze the villages and turn it into agricultural land.
So yeah, they were trying to create those agro factories, weren't they?
That's right. Completely bonkers. Yeah. But Skornicest was, you know, pretty dreadful place, but not quite so dreadful as all the rest of Romania. Within about 2 milliseconds of us arriving, we were being followed by Securitate types in what I called a car with dark glasses. It was a car. It was one of those dreadful Dacias, the Romanian version of the Renault. It was Renault 5, I can't remember which Renault it was. But anyway, it was the Romanian version because Renault had a joint production agreement like Fiat had with Russia, with the Soviet Union for the Jiguli. Anyway, this Romanian car with all of the windows dark, including the main front screen, turned up near us. And before we could really get much done or anything recorded, we got marched off and interviewed and told that we were breaching everything, you know, under the sun. And they let us go with a sharp warning. And we drove on to Bucharest, which was grim. Oh, my God, was Bucharest grim in those days. Couldn't believe it. And when I went back there for the revolution in December 1989, it was just as grim, if not worse. So I met a few people and did a few interviews, and we drove back to Vienna. And I was declared persona non grata, not publicly, but I was not allowed back into Romania until the fall of Ceausescu, which we will get to. And shortly after that, I was put forward by the BBC to be the BBC's Moscow correspondent to take over from John Osman, I think it was. And the Russians refused. They just strung it out. So I never got to Russia as Moscow correspondent. Life would have been very different. I might have turned into Bridget Kendall or someone very famous instead of being me. So that's why I went to China.
You're great being you. I'm so enjoying this conversation.
Anyway, so I couldn't get back to Romania, but I carried on slandering Ceausescu and, you know, undermining the socialist state order and so on merrily for the next 3 years, for the rest of my time in Vienna until 1984, when I went to China as a BBC radio correspondent.
Right. And tell me about China, because, I mean, that must have been quite a different posting, because you would have got very used to Europe and the way of working there. Was China hugely different?
I completely fell in love with China when I got there. It was the most extraordinary experience. I took over from Stephen Jessel, who went on to be the BBC's Paris correspondent. Boy, couldn't he wait to get out. Stephen loathed China with a visceral loathing. It was just, I mean, you could have cut his loathing with a knife. And he was foul about China in all his reporting, I'm afraid. But Philip Short had been the first BBC correspondent in China before Stephen Jessel. And Philip wrote a wonderful book about China and Russia, because he was Moscow correspondent for the BBC when I was there for Reuters. So I knew Philip very well. And he wrote The Dragon and the Bear, extremely good book about the two communist systems. Captured it very well. So I'd read that before I went. But when I got to Beijing, or Peking, as we called it in those days still, the quality of the food, basically, I could not believe the quality of the cooking in China. And the sense of tradition that was still alive. There was a proud tradition. And there was a quality, despite the awfulness of the system, which was nothing like as awful as the Russian system, it felt at the time. There was a kind of quality and a pride, which I felt the Soviet system was breaking in the Russians. Russian men with their drinking, the kind of breakdown of basic order and the functioning of the state in Russia. Nobody cared in Russia or in the Soviet Union. And we didn't talk about Russia in those days. We talked about the Soviet Union. And I used to correct people. No, it's the Soviet Union, not Russia. But people just didn't care. They had their private lives, but they simply didn't care about the state structure or the public spaces. They threw rubbish around. You know, there was no maintenance. It was very, very run down. The Soviet Union was incredibly run down. China wasn't. China was totally different. The Chinese looked after things. It was still very basic. You couldn't get much in the shops. It was sort of felt very communist or very socialist, should we say. But it was totally, totally different in that sense. I just loved it. But the Chinese are very different from the Russians. The Russians are like us. I mean, they're Eastern versions of Europeans. They're very, very European. I think they're much more European than Asian. But the Chinese, obviously, are rather Asian. So The quality of contact to the Chinese was very different from the quality of contact to the Russians. And the single most important difference, I'd say, is that the Russians are individuals. They are not a collective. I mean, when they fight wars, they are a collective. But in day-to-day life, you know, look at Tolstoy and Dostoevsky. There's a proud tradition of being individual and being drunk and kicking back against whoever, authority. The Chinese are a collective, and they experience themselves psychologically as part of a collective. They're ants. You know, it's a bit of a cliche, but they experience themselves as part of a much bigger whole. And the Russians don't. Perhaps a little bit more these days than they used to. But so talking to Chinese was totally different from talking to the Russians. The Russians talk to Sakharov or Sharansky or whoever. Alyosha, my very drunken Russian friend, closest friend, who died, of course, of drink before he reached 50. Talked to them, and it was, you could talk, you could joke, you could talk about ordinary life, you shared the same sense of humor and perspective on life. But the Chinese, I talked to a young journalist from China Daily, which was just developing then as a rather good English language newspaper in China, in Beijing, in Peking. And he said to me, "Mark, can you explain to me what an individual is?" We literally asked the question, "Can you explain what it means to be an individual? Because I feel myself as part of the Danwei, the collective, the family, the bigger family." So it was totally different, and I loved China. I was very glad to leave after 3 years, but China was just endlessly fascinating. And of course, it was all opening up, 84 to 87. It was before Tiananmen Square. And I remember thinking, because I was there when the agreement, the Hong Kong agreement, was signed in late 1984, when Thatcher and Deng Xiaoping signed the handover agreement, which came into force in 1997. And there was a lot of fear and loathing saying, you know, the Chinese are going to take over Hong Kong and it'll ruin Hong Kong. I mean, it's now a little bit complicated, but at the time I remember thinking, no, it's going to be the other way around. Not in democratic terms, but in economic terms and social terms, Hong Kong will take over China. And I think I've been proved right. You know, China is extraordinary going back there now and how modern it is.
Yeah.
I need to let you get a question in edgeways.
No. Well, what I tend to do is I do tend to let my guests talk rather than, because people want to hear you rather than me. So you're there for the Gorbachev visit.
Yes, I was. So I was Beijing Peking correspondent for BBC Radio from October 1984 through to November 1987, when I came back to London, moved back to London, put kids in school in England, took about an 80% cut in real income, as one did in those days, and became BBC World Service diplomatic correspondent based at Bush House. So for those 3 years that I was in Beijing, I covered really the economics. Wham came and played in Beijing, Peking, and caused a bit of a brouhaha. There was a certain amount of political protest in Shanghai, kind of split in the Communist Party, which you were feeling. The reformers were in the ascendant when I was there, and Deng Xiaoping was giving his backing to the reformers, the cautious reformers. So it was a fairly heady time, not a political massive political opening up, but curiosity and interest in the outside world and culture. And when I needed a tonic, I used to go to a particular park in Beijing and Peking, to the English Corner, where Chinese students of English would congregate of a Sunday morning and talk in English to each other and have earnest conversations, a bit like Hyde Park Corner, not about politics, but about Dickens and the West and life. And so I used to go down there, and whenever I was down, I just used to go to English Corner and just recharge the batteries, because they were so thrilled to have a real Englishman that they could practice on, especially the BBC, Yingguo Guangbo Dentai, the English Broadcasting Corporation, as the Chinese called it. So those were very interesting times up to 87, and there was a sense of reform and push and pull. And I went back to Beijing for the first time after leaving in November 1987 to cover the Gorbachev visit, the great thaw between the Soviet Union and Communist China, in May 1989. And that, of course, turned into Tiananmen Square. And boy, was that a story. Blimey, was that a story. And I, true to form, left town before it really hit the fan. And the most traumatic experience of my entire journalistic life was being on the North Norfolk coast, hearing about the tanks going onto Tiananmen Square in the evening of Saturday, June the 3rd, 1989, etched on my consciousness. My goodness me. My wife, then still Jutta, now again Jutta, after a 13-year break, said I literally went green because I wasn't there.
No, I can imagine. I mean, if you're a journalist, to know that you've missed out on a story like that by a matter of days, because stories like that don't, you know, that's a one in a lifetime story, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's like not being around for the fall of the Berlin Wall.
Guess where I wasn't when the wall came down. Guess where I wasn't when the Velvet Revolution happened. And guess who was the very first person to say, please, me, when the report came in December 1989 from Revolution Square in Bucharest, that the crowds had started chanting Jos Comunismul, Jos Ceausescu, down with Ceausescu, down with communism. Let me tell you that story, Ian. That's a good one.
Go on. We've been teeing that up for, well, quite some time now. So tell me about Romania in 1989. Cheap trick, I know, but I'm afraid we're going to have to leave you on a cliffhanger there. You'll hear more in episode 3. And we have further photos, videos and information on this episode in our show notes, which will show as a link in your podcast app. Don't forget, if you'd like to get one of those Cold War Conversations coasters, help keep us on the air, then head over to coldwarconversations.com/donate. And if you can't wait for the next episode, do visit our Facebook discussion group, where listeners just like you continue the Cold War conversation. Just search for Cold War Conversations in Facebook. Thank you very much for listening. It is really appreciated. Goodbye. Not enjoying the ads? Well, you can avoid them by going to coldwarconversations.com/donate. By becoming a monthly or annual supporter, you'll enjoy ad-free listening, become a part of our community, receive the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster, and bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate for more information.